Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. Our guest this evening for the first half hour is Joseph Dorman from Riverside Films. Riverside Films specializes in documentaries, and Mr. Dorman has won various awards, starting with his documentary Arguing the World, about the controversial 60-year political journey of the most famous political writers and thinkers of the New York intellectuals, all four of them who happen to be Jewish: Daniel Bell, Irving Howe, Irving Kristol, and Nathan Glazer. These four people started as extreme leftists, and as they got older, as they looked at the world, as they thought out their ideas, they found their way to just right of center, or in the case of Irving Kristol, as the father of neoconservatism. Good evening, Mr. Dorman.
Good evening, Chaim. Nice to be here. Let me just correct you a little that the Irving Howe remained a man of the left his whole life, and I think
right.
that Daniel Bell would consider himself a left center, but they all moved right from where they had been, but didn't end up on
However,
the right.
Even Irving Howe, towards his later years, was not as much of a socialist as he had been during his youth.
Absolutely, but I don't think
in relation to the new left.
Absolutely. I just don't think he would have considered himself a man right of center. That's the only thing he might have choked on a little, shall we say.
What was interesting about all four of them is that, unlike those on the political debate today, rather than calling names and other expletive deleted, shall we say, they actually debated their ideas. They respected each other. They disagreed, but they respected and used their intellect rather than vituperatives. Unfortunately, today, that is not the case. Both sides of the political spectrum and everything in between, whenever they disagree on something, the first thing they go to is character assassination. I guess today we lack the intellectual capacity to come up with a good fighting argument.
Yeah, well, I think that although these guys could get quite heated in debate, I think your point is well taken. And I think part of the reason for that was that these were men of the pen, of the typewriter, men of the written word.
Right.
And I think that although TV is clearly one of the most effective means for communication, and now we have Twitter and Facebook and other social media,
right.
but unfortunately what people have learned very quickly is that what is effective on TV is not necessarily complexity of debate, quite the opposite. It's simplicity of debate or simplicity of point, and simplification ultimately ends up distorting more than it does clarifying.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
The interesting thing, though, is that even though none of them was particularly religious, throughout their writing, throughout their debate, you can see that whether they admit it or not, they're very, very Jewish at heart.
Absolutely. And I think none of them would have had any bit of trouble admitting that at all. I think that one of the interesting things about all four of these men and was that in their youth, like so many sons of immigrants, and these men were born in the 20s, they were very much initially in their early years all about assimilating, about becoming Americans. But they learned very quickly, and part of for them becoming Americans, and this may seem odd because it's so marginal to the American political debate, but part of becoming American for them meant radicalism meant joining what seemed like international movements that would dissolve the differences between Jews and non-Jews, and that was true of Jews in Eastern Europe as well as in America and other countries. But I think they quickly learned as they grew older, and when I say older, I mean in their 20s, they quickly understood that they were very much Jews. They were both Americans and Jews, and they very much identified and found sustenance in their Jewish heritage, all in different ways. Irving Howe was a man who grew, although not was probably the least religious of all of them, was someone who was very invested in the recovery and spread of Yiddish literature and devoted enormous amount of his life to that. Irving Kristol was someone who, although was never a shulgoer himself, was someone who was very much a believer in religion and its importance. And at one point, I should say that Kristol, Glaser, and Bell joined or formed a study group to study the Talmud because they were very much interested in their Jewish heritage and wanted to learn about it. So they were very, very invested in their Jewish identity, I think.
Now, tell me, you seem to be of a generation just younger than mine, but even in your generation, every Jewish mother's dream was to talk about her son, the doctor, her son, the lawyer. Mm. How did you get into cinematography? How does a nice Jewish boy end up as a filmmaker?
Well, he stumbles into it in my case, and my parents initially were not so happy. My mother was a classic Jewish mother in the sense that she certainly wanted, on the one hand, me to be successful. On the other hand, whatever I did, she considered a success. There were certain pieces of artwork I did in my youth that I could only be described as hideously ugly that she nevertheless embraced and quelled over. My father really continued to want me when he himself was a doctor and wanted me to be a doctor when it was clear that I wasn't going to be. He switched quickly into lawyer mode and only reluctantly learned to accept the fact that I wasn't going to be a lawyer. But they were ultimately, when they saw that this was what I wanted to do, that I wanted to make film, I think they were, in the end, both very supportive of it. And they've been, both of them passed away 10 and 12 years ago, but they did get to see the first film I made and were excited about that success. I have to say that as I said, I kind of stumbled into it. I knew that I wanted to do something creative. I was interested in writing. I had always been interested in film. But really, it was only when a good friend of mine, actually a woman I had met when I was in Israel on kibbutz, and we subsequently both moved to New York and remained good friends. And one day, we were teaching high school at that point. One day, she said, "Hey, I'm going to go to do a summer film workshop." And I said, "Hey, I want to do that too." And now, some 25, 30 years later, I'm a filmmaker, and of course, she ended up being a lawyer. So you never know.
Right. After arguing the world, you then went ahead and did another project, which is now showing around the country, and that is Sholem Aleichem, Laughing in Darkness. Want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, absolutely. After I finished the Arguing the World, I was desperately looking for another project and having a very hard time finding one. And it was really a friend of mine, a man named Jeffrey Chandler, who's a professor of Yiddish at Rutgers, who suggested the idea of making a film on Sholem Aleichem. And really, I was really deeply ignorant about Sholem Aleichem in Yiddish literature. I was woefully ignorant. He mentioned this idea. I was quite skeptical at first, except for the fact that I knew and respected Jeffrey and knew he was, an incredibly smart man. He himself was a professor of Yiddish, so I thought, if he thinks it's a good idea, I at least should check it out. And all I knew at that point of Shalom Aleichem really was I knew the name, right? I knew Fiddler on the Roof. I had liked Fiddler on the Roof. I hadn't been a devotee of it, but I remember seeing it as a young man and liking it. I can remember our family had a Shalom Aleichem book on the bookshelf, Tevi and his daughters. I don't remember a person in our family ever picking up that book, but it was there on the bookshelf. But quickly, when I started to read Shalom Aleichem and read about him, I was immediately enchanted. I realized this was not a kind of musty old folk writer as I had imagined him to be, and as so many people misconstrue him, not some outdated Borscht Belt Jewish comedian, but a man who was actually a brilliant and sophisticated writer and who had plumbed the depths of the Jewish soul as very few other modern writers have. And that's what makes him a great Jewish writer. It makes him a great writer.
Oh, my God. They came back. Did I get scared? They crashed for a second.
Ah.
Okay, go ahead.
Did you hear about my belief that he plumbed the depths of the Jewish soul?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The fact is, not only the depths of the Jewish soul, even though every single one of his characters is very, very Jewish, every single one of the situations that he describes also has, you know, a tremendous amount of Jewishness within it. The fact is, the feelings of those characters, the reactions of those characters, are universal.
Absolutely.
And that's what makes
him
such a great writer.
Absolutely. That's an extremely good point, and I'm glad you brought it up. I mean, I think what makes a great writer, his ability to take the particular and to make it universal. Tolstoy wrote about Russia as few writers have, and yet Tolstoy is not merely a Russian writer, although he is a great Russian writer. He's a writer who explores the human condition, and what made Shalom Aleichem such a great writer was that he was able to take what was happening with Jews in Eastern Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century, this journey Jews were going on from small shtetls to larger cities, both in the Pale and in America, which is exactly the same journey as that from a traditional world to a modern one. And he explored that in a quite a remarkable way, as few other writers have. And what was a very confusing journey for what was essentially an impoverished, not an illiterate, but an uneducated, for the most part, Jewish population, he made that understandable to them through his stories. And he took what was an enormously complex, confusing situation and somehow was able to communicate that in a way that these Jews could understand, and not only understand, but laugh at all the troubles they were experiencing, not only the disorientations and confusions, but the terrible violence, the anti-Semitic violence that was taking place at that moment in Eastern Europe. So this was really quite a remarkable feat for a man to do.
Absolutely, and not only Jews. For example, Mark Twain used to refer to Shalom Aleichem, used to say about himself that he considered himself the American Shalom Aleichem.
It's unclear whether that's true or apocryphal, but it's absolutely true. They were men who used pseudonyms, who were very sophisticated writers,
right,
reaching out to a much less sophisticated audience. But, you know, the universality of Shalom Aleichem is plain with a couple of very simple anecdotes. One, of course, is the absolute Fiddler on the Roof, the absolute universal appeal. It became an international hit, and there's a story of it being shown in Japan, and an audience member turning to one of the American producers and saying, "Tell me, they understand this in America? It's so Japanese." And one of my favorite Japanese filmmakers, a man who's considered so quintessentially Japanese that he didn't travel to America like Akira Kurosawa, a man named Yasujiro Ozu, he has made film after film. He died a number of years ago, but he did make film after film about daughters leaving fathers, much as Tevye's daughters leave their father. And I was just recently at the yard site for Shalom Aleichem, which has been taking place every year since his death, when he wrote up his will, one of the things he asked of his children to not only say Kaddish for him, but he asked that they would get together every year on the anniversary of his death and read some of his funniest stories. And they have been doing that every year since his death in 1916. With increasingly larger people, they invite anyone who loves Shlomo Aleichem to come. It now takes place at the Brotherhood Synagogue in Murray Hill in New York. But when I was there in the recent one, it takes place around May 13th, the day of his death, there were five men there from China. And the reason they were there is because these five men are starting in Shanghai a Shlomo Aleichem Research Center. Now, it's a remarkable thing, and what's remarkable about that, it seems odd. Why in China would they be interested in Shlomo Aleichem? And the answer is really a very simple one, because today in China, millions of people are moving from small villages to large cities. They're experiencing that same journey from a traditional world to a modern one that Jews were experiencing in the late 19th century with all its attendant confusions and disruptions. And they are also experiencing that interest in holding on to their Chinese identity as Jews have struggled to maintain their Jewish identity in a world that it's not as easy to do once as it was 100 years ago.
What is interesting about China, for example, Adin Steinsaltz,
mm-hmm.
who did a translation of the Talmud into English, and he took the Talmud in Hebrew even, and explained it in a modern manner, making it easy to understand by the reader today. He goes to Communist China every year, once a year, and he gives a class to government officials on Pirkei Avot, the ethics of the fathers.
Huh.
At the invitation of the Chinese government. It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really interesting. They invited him to do this, huh?
They invited him to do this, yes.
Fascinating. Well, it's remarkable.
Now,
go ahead.
What other projects are you working on? And when is this particular film coming to New York, by the way?
Yeah,
I know
that's
it already
a good
played
point.
In New York once, and it's coming back, I understand.
That's correct. We had a very, very good, a very successful run in New York in July and August at a number of theaters all over the New York region. And it's now coming back for 1 week, a one-week engagement at the Village East Cinemas on 2nd Avenue. I think it's 2nd Avenue and 12th Street. It happens to be an old Yiddish theater that's been converted into a modern cinema multiplex. So it's got a rich history and an appropriate place for Shlomo Aleichem to be playing. And it's coming there from September 30th to October 6th. And meanwhile, it's continuing its run around the country. It's in a number of cities and states. We're in Virginia and California, Los Angeles, in the San Francisco area. We're in Boston and Chicago. And the best thing for your listeners to do is to go to our website, www.shlomoaleichemthemovie.com. And they can go on the screenings page and find out where it is across the country, if, in addition to New York, if they live outside the city or they have friends who might be interested in seeing the film. As for my next project, I have a number of them, but probably the one most of interest to your listeners would be A History of the Zionist Idea. And in some ways, I see the film as part of a trilogy of films about the modern Jewish world, in the sense that Benjamin Harshab, the brilliant Israeli scholar who now teaches at Yale University, describes what he calls the modern Jewish revolution, and that's the revolution that took place in consciousness among Jews, really beginning in the late 19th century, at the moment that Shlomo Aleichem himself was beginning to write. And out of that modern Jewish revolution came Yiddish literature, Shlomo Aleichem and his colleagues and his successors. Out of that came also Jewish radicalism, which was the subject of Arguing the World, and of course out of that also came the Zionist movement, which is the subject of this upcoming film. So we'll be looking at the history of the idea of Zionism, how it came to be, as opposed to, I guess what I'm saying, as opposed to a history of the State of Israel, of which there have been a number of films. This really looks at the idea of Zionism and its evolution. It started out, of course, as an anti-religious secular idea, but as we all know, it was adopted by, initially early on, by Rav Kook, and there became a strand of religious Zionism. And then, of course, in recent years, we know that numbers of religious Jews have taken on the Zionist cause. So it'll be looking at the evolution of the idea, the arguments within Zionism, and the different strands of Zionism, and how they came to be, and what their different opinions are about the future of the State of Israel.
Are there any other projects that you're involved in at present or that you're finishing off?
I'm also working, and this is for, I always have a few projects going. It's important to do that. I'm also working with colleagues and with the firm of Ralph Applebaum Associates, the very well-known museum design firm. We're working on a Jewish museum in Moscow, which the Lubavitch community is sponsoring there. It's a very exciting project. It's the first time that the history of Russian Jewry will be presented to a general Russian audience. It's going to be located in Moscow at a beautiful, historic, early 20th century Soviet building, which Vladimir Putin apparently has... It's my understanding that he's sold or leased to the Jewish community for a dollar. So that's a very exciting project. I'm also working on, I have both Jewish and non-Jewish projects. I'm working on another project that I am very excited about a remarkable doctor, a man named James Oleski, who practices in Newark, who was an AIDS pioneer, really a remarkable man. He was one of the first people to understand, even before we understood what AIDS was, he was among the first to really understand that AIDS could be transmitted between mothers and children in childbirth. And now he's working with children in pain and children with serious terminal illnesses. And he's really I keep using the word remarkable, but he really is a remarkable caregiver and physician and healer. So I'm quite excited about that project, which looks at his history and what his work is today.
On your project on the history of Russian Jewry, will that include even the infamous chapters, the persecutions and the murders of Jewish intellectuals and that? Or considering that it is in Russia, which is not yet in spite of what they're trying to say, it is not yet a free society, will anything be hidden?
No, I think that the idea behind this is to really show the true history. And we will definitely be showing, I'm working, of course, on the film part. There's also a very, the bulk of the museum is non-filmic elements, but the whole team is working very hard to tell the real story of Russian Jewry, and that involves everything from the early support of Yiddish in the early Soviet Union and its early anti-Semitic campaign, the first in the history of the world, to the complete turnaround into a deeply anti-Semitic regime under Stalin and the murder of Yiddish writers and scientists. And, of course, in the early 50s, just as Stalin was, just as he was dying, he was on the verge of what seemed to be a wholesale pogrom against Jews in the 50s, and that pogrom really didn't happen only because of his death.
Right.
So it'll be
because
looking at
death,
both
right.
Because of his death, right. So it'll be looking at both the positive moments for Jews in the Soviet Union and what probably ends up being the much larger low moments for Jews. One of the interesting things the museum is trying to look at, and I think this is important, is that it's trying also to be very complex in its portrayal of Russian Jewry. And one of the interesting things about Jewry under the Soviet Union was before it became a deeply anti-Semitic regime. In the 20s and 30s, the Soviet Union actually offered Jews a chance to assimilate into Soviet society in a way they never had before under Imperial Russia. So there was actually a high moment for Jews in the early Soviet Union, which of course quickly turned in the opposite direction. But even under the most anti-Semitic circumstances in the Soviet Union, there were Jews who managed to be very successful, who became important members of society, scientists, doctors. I mean, we know of some of these people. So it's obviously a very mixed history, and there's some very, very dark moments, and those will not be shied away from. But the museum is interested in painting a very complex and full portrait of Soviet Jewry.
Well, one of the during the period of the 50s and the 60s, my father, of blessed memory, had two brothers who, during the war, escaped from Poland to Russia. Mm. One of them became a physicist, a nuclear physicist. The other brother became the manager, or one of the managers at the gun department store, which was a store for diplomats and for the elite.
Uh-huh.
When the second brother, the manager, left Russia in the early 60s, his own brother did not dare come to say goodbye to him at the train station.
Right.
Had he said goodbye to a traitor, I mean, he would have been jailed himself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think the perfidy of the Soviet regime, you know, is well known, and that's a very great example. And of course, we know that as Jews chose to leave the Soviet Union starting in the 60s and 70s, they faced enormous obloquy from the Soviet government. And it's really a remarkable testament to Soviet Jews that despite the hardships visited upon them, people, of course, like Natan Sharansky and many, many others, they persisted not only in pleading their case to go to Israel, but they and America, of course, but they also managed to, and this is what's remarkable, you have a regime doing everything it can to wipe out all religion, and that included mm-hmm. Jewish religion, that these were people who managed somehow to begin to re-educate themselves under these conditions, when it was so hard to do, that people began to form underground study groups and reattach themselves to a whole religious life that was all but destroyed by the Soviet government.
Now, let me ask you one question. All this work, all this research with Jewish subjects, how has it changed you? What impact did it have upon you, Joseph Dorman?
Yeah, it's a very good question, Chaim. I think that, you know, I didn't set out to make Jewish films, but somehow I ended up making them. My first film, Arguing the World, I didn't even consider it a Jewish film, although it was obviously about Jewish intellectuals. I really thought about it because these were men who had been anti-communists and anti-totalitarian. I saw it as a political history, but of course it was more than that. And then with Shalom Aleichem, I knew from the moment, of course, that was about Jewish history. I think the thing about the projects I choose to do is that they have to somehow move me. They have to touch me in some way. I do work for hire as well. There are a lot of interesting subjects out there. I'm a curious person, I think, and I love studying all sorts of subjects, and there are many different kinds of films to be made and that I would like to make. But there clearly is something in these Jewish subjects that touches my soul, that has been very important for me. I'm not a regular shul goer, although I do go to shul from time to time. My religious identity, or my Jewish identity, I should say, is deeply important to me. And Jewish history is deeply important to me, and it's been a way for me, an important way for me to affirm my Jewish identity and to understand it. And particularly in this last project, I think that one of the sort of accidental tragedies of American Jewry has been that we really have become cut off from this history. We all grow up understanding that our parents or grandparents or great-grandparents came from the shtetl, but we know very little about the shtetl. And how can you fully, we are people of the book, we are people essentially in many ways, we are among the inventors of history. That's in part what the Bible is, along with the Greeks and the Romans. And yet somehow we who are so invested in our history somehow have lost touch with that history. And I think that that's crucial, whether you're a religious Jew or a non-religious Jew, understanding where we came from and what our roots are in Eastern Europe are fundamental. And so I went into this project, as I do with all my projects, with many questions. I don't ever get as many answers as I'd like. Often I get more questions than I began with, but I'd like to think that those questions end up being richer, more thoughtful, more interesting questions, the kind of questions that keep one thinking about one's Jewish identity, about one's Judaism, and that's what's important to me.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Dorman. You've been very informative. There are so many questions I would still love to ask, but we're out of time. I'm going to have no choice, but we must have you on in our show again.
I'd love to do it, Chaim, and thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very, very much for appearing. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
And our next guest for the next half hour is Aaron Ritter, founder and president of the Kosher Wine Society. Good evening, Aaron.
Good evening. How are you today?
Baruch Hashem. Glad to have you back on our show.
I'm very excited to be on the show tonight. Thank you for having me.
Okay, now tell us a little bit about what the Kosher Wine Society has been doing since we spoke to you last, right before Pesach, and what are its upcoming activities?
Fantastic. Yeah, so we've been busy over the last couple of months planning different wine tasting events and scotch tasting events, and I'm excited about our next event, very excited, because it's a winery that I really appreciate and adore and think the owner is an incredible, first of all, human being, but second of all, fantastic wines that they make. So that event that's coming up is next Tuesday, and it's with Dalton Winery, a winery from Israel. And I had the privilege of visiting that winery in March of this year. And it was a phenomenal experience of visiting the winery, seeing what was really going on, being one of the first to taste the Alma wines, the new series of wines that we're going to be tasting on Tuesday night. And it was so fascinating to me. He pretty much took a jar out of this wine right out of the barrel to taste, and it was fantastic. And, it was an exciting...
selections they have not had before? Brand new selections?
Yep. Yeah, these are the brand new selections that we're going to be
having. Not just new vintages, but new selections.
New selections, yep, exactly. So the Alma series is not a new series, but the wines, some of the wines that we're talking about are new. And that's pretty much what we're going to be having on Tuesday night next week.
And where is this taking place?
So the event's on 34th Street and 9th Avenue, between 8th and 9th Avenue. And I'm doing something for your listeners tonight, that if anyone emails me at info@kosherwinesociety.com. And would like to attend, we're going to be doing a 2-for-1 on the event. So it's $65. So we're doing 2-for-1. So it's going to be $32 and
50 cents per person, basically.
That's it.
Here,
an easy
give
math,
us your
right?
Email again, please. Absolutely.
My email address is info, I-N-F-O, at kosherwinesociety.com. And you can find us online, obviously, at kosherwinesociety.com. You can read up about the past events we've had, our future events that we're going to be having. And, you know, what's great about this specific one is that it's a really great opportunity to meet Alex, the owner of the winery. He's going to be talking about his...
Alex
Aruni, correct. So the two specific wines that I'm talking about that are brand new is the 2010 Dalton Alma White, and that's a blend of Chardonnay and Viognier, which is a grape varietal that is not typically found in Israel. So it's pretty unique. And the Dalta Alma Shiraz, Mourvèdre, and Viognier. Okay, and this is a red wine that has a white wine in it, which is the Viognier, which kind of gives it this little fruitiness, a good amount of fruitiness to the wine, and it makes it truly, truly unique. We're also tasting the Dalton Estate Shiraz and the Dalton Reserve Shiraz, the 07 and the 09. And in Israel, the 08s was a Shemitah year. So, we don't have any of the 08s here in the U.S. I shouldn't say we don't have any of them. We have some of them, not all of them. So it was a Shemitah year, so we're going to be tasting those side by side. And Alex always throws something in, so we might have some additional other items, presented.
What other activities do you have this month?
So that is, just that the Dalton event is September 13th. It's a Tuesday night next week, and we're doing the 2-for-1 special on that one. The name of the place that it's at is Zanger Hall, which is 347 West 34th Street. The next event that we're doing is an exciting event as well, which I love it because every year it really is I think it's a very unique event, and they're both very different wine tasting events. The one on the 21st of September is called New Wines for the New Year. So what I've done is I've put together a list of, I believe right now we're at 48 different wines to taste. Obviously, it's a different format of a tasting. It is a tasting that is a walk-around event. And so you'll be able to taste a lot of different wines, but you're not going to really have an opportunity to get the education. The Dalton wine tasting is really an educational learning about the wine, a sit-down wine tasting event for someone that's looking to learn about wine and education and wine in general. The event on the 21st is an event more to just, see what's out there, what's new out there. So we have wineries, a tremendous amount from Israel, a tremendous amount from, Israel obviously is producing, more and more new kosher wines coming to the U.S., new vintages. So we're going to have Yarden, we're going to have Carmel, we're going to have Reconati doing their special reserve. Alex Haruni from Dalton is going to be showing, I think, two of his wines. So it's going to be a unique, wonderful evening of wine tasting, and that's on the 21st of September. It's a Wednesday night. And we're doing, for Kosher Wine Society members, extra half an hour. So the event's going to start for everyone at 7:30, and Kosher Wine Society members get to have a little VIP section, come in early, come taste the wines a half an hour earlier, and it's going to be a wonderful night. We're also going to have a book signing and a new book that I was a contributor with. And it's called the Kosher Carnivore. And June Hirsch will be there, and it's going to be an exciting night. She'll have an opportunity to get up and speak for a couple of minutes and talk about the Kosher Carnivore. And the book is an exciting new cookbook, and it's got a lot of exciting new features that I think would be very that are very exciting for a kosher wine and kosher person that's looking to taste, to eat great, fantastic recipes and food.
Considering I'm a hardcore carnivore, just that title of that cookbook is already making my mouth water, and I can't wait to be there. By the way, we will be doing a live show from that venue.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I'm excited that you're going to be joining us for the live show and the live opportunity to hear about the wines and hear about the June and the book The Kosher Carnivore. And it's an exciting evening of wine tasting in New York City, September 21st. The tickets, there's actually a deal that J Deal is doing, and that's an organization that has a website, and they're going to be doing it this weekend. So it's a fantastic deal. We're doing two tickets for $60. Regular price are $40 a ticket, so it's $80. So they're giving $10 off each ticket on that one. Not as good as the 2-for-1, though, I must admit, but it's still a very good deal.
Absolutely. I've attended your meetings before, and I'm definitely going to say that I've been a witness to the fact that you get your money's worth. There's no
question. Absolutely.
Including the first time that I went, which was on your 30th birthday when you had the bourbon and cigar evening.
Correct. I remember that night. Beautiful night in New York City it was.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And,
Go ahead, keep going. No.
Sorry.
Okay, let me ask you something. Considering that not everybody in our audience is sophisticated about wine, as the president of the Kosher Wine Society, why don't you give the audience a few pointers on how they can get started with the pleasures of wine tasting?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean by that is, about 30 years ago, if you spoke about kosher wine, you were obviously speaking about a very, very extra sweet wine. In fact, when I came to this country in 1962 from South America, the choices in wine were extra sweet and even sweeter. All of a sudden, about 30 years ago, they started the revolution with the dry wines. That was specifically Levana's restaurant. And when they started with the dry wines, everybody was saying, they got to be crazy. Who's going to drink that? Well, 30 years later, most of our wines are dry wines. And lo and behold, surprise, surprise, Jews do appreciate good dry wines. So please explain to our audience, how does one get started in tasting wines and appreciating them?
Well, I think the first thing that a person would need to have is a passion or an excitement or an openness to try something new. And with wine tasting, it is always something new. Every bottle that you taste, every time you open a bottle of wine, you're not going to have it's not made in the same way that a Manischewitz is made. It's not made in the same way that a Sweet Concord is made. It's every single type of winery will make their wines different. And every time you open a bottle, it's a different experience. Every type of grape that you try, it's a new type of grape. So you can compare and contrast from what you know in your own mind. And that's how you learn, is by trying. That's a trial and error, and I've been out lately a good amount, and I've tried a lot of different wines, and some wines are just fantastic, and some wines, I'm learning about my palate and what I like, and for me, I love Pinot Noirs, I love Cabernets, I've had a lot of Malbecs lately, and I'm not a personal fan of a Malbec. I mean, yes, there are some good ones out there, but overall, that's not my flavor. I like the fruit, the boldness of the Pinot Noir and the Cabernets. That's more my style. So when someone asks me, what's your favorite wine, I typically say to them, my favorite varietal is a Cabernet. That's what I'm going to typically like, and I've had very, very good Cabernets. I've had, Castel is a blend of a Cabernet and Merlot. I've had some fantastic Cabernets from Covenant Winery. I've had some fantastic wines from Tishby, Cabernets. I've had some great Pinot Noirs as well, you know, and that's
Tishby in general has some superb wines.
Say that again?
Tishby in general has some superb wines.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, so a lot has to do with the winemaker, the winery. You know, a lot of the cheaper wines. There are some good cheap wines out there, and I was just kind of reading up, and I need to do a little bit more research on the $3 wines at Trader Joe's. I haven't done much on them, and maybe that's something that they're doing kosher wines in Trader Joe's right now. $3-4 a bottle, and I have not tasted them.
Wow.
I've not had a chance to. Kosher, and I that's one of the things that I will be working on is that list, you know, under $10 list that is definitely going to be a good hit.
Wow.
Yeah. So in terms of tasting wines, you know, I think a person that's learning to taste new wines has to be open. They have to be willing to try something new. Willing to not like it. And, you know, great place to start is always in restaurants because you can ask for a little taste of a type of wine. And so every time you walk in, you can ask for a little, you know, let me try this one. Let me try this one. Let me get a little taste, and then I'll see if I want to order a glass. And
how does the average Jew who's used to sweet wine suddenly start appreciating a dry wine? I mean, the first time must be a cultural shock, let's face it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so there are a couple of wineries that have done some great things with that. There's a wine called Jeunesse, which is a semi-sweet. And there's a couple of other ones, the Claret. These are all wines that are made with a little touch of sweetness in a certain sense. So when you taste it, you're not tasting 100% a Cabernet, even though it is 100% Cabernet, but there's a sweetness to it. And it's all about how the winemaker chooses to make his wine, you know, whether he adds, you know, sweet Cabernet or whether he stops the fermentation a little earlier, so there's a lot of sugar content in the wine. There's a couple of things that the winemaker can do, and each one of those things will add a little, kind of a little different flavor to the wine. There's also another wine called the Lioness, which is made by Oda Mountain, which is a winery in the northern part of Israel. It's fantastic if you have a chance to get up there. Beautiful. I mean, you see the mountains, and it's an incredible, incredible place to visit in the middle of nowhere. And it's this little teeny winery called Oda Mountain, and they make some phenomenal, phenomenal wines. And they have a wine called the Lioness, which is the same type of concept, a sweetish, sweeter wine. And it's a really fun wine to try, and especially for the new wine connoisseur, it's definitely something to do. We also offer wine 101 classes, and that's obviously you know, something that you'll do to take it to an extra level, a little deeper on the educational level. And, you know, Alex's
and what
class
is the cost
on Tuesday,
of those classes?
Typically between $40 and $50, depends on the venue and the evening. And, you know, what's great about Alex's class is that you really get to learn from the owner of the winery. You get to learn, you know, you hear the story of Dalton.
Right.
You know, so it's an educational event, you know, in a certain sense, and I think it's a wonderful opportunity for your listeners, for kosher wine connoisseurs to come out and try his wines and really hear from someone that is you know, at the forefront of the kosher wine, Israeli wine industry.
Okay. How did you get into the wine business? I understand that you're an accountant.
I'm trained as a CPA. I work at a bank right now, HSBC. I work at a bank. My background, when I was working at my accounting firm at the time, I was looking for a hobby. I was looking for something to do to get out there and you know, a hobby, something to just kind of put my head into outside of work. And I had an opportunity to go online, go onto Google, and find nothing out there for the kosher wine consumer. And I said, this is a great opportunity to create, and see if there's an opportunity here. And my first event, I had 25 people, mostly family and friends. By the next event, I had 75 people that I did not know at the event. And, you know, I realized at that point that there is an opportunity here, that this is an exciting industry, you know. And at my first event, I got an offer to distribute wines at a wine company. So here I am. It's December of 2005, and I get an offer, and it's right before busy season in accounting, and I get an offer literally December, you know, maybe it was the first week of January, and we're right about to go into busy season, and I said, I can't do this for another 4 or 5 months. This is not what I want to be doing. And I took the job in the wine company, and I distributed wines in New York City, really learning, you know, like my formal education was on-the-job training, tasting wines every single day, tasting every single new wine that came out, an opportunity to meet with wine owners and owners of wine stores and really get to know the industry. And, you know, it's an exciting...
F. A. O. Schwartz, right?
Say that again?
Like a little kid at basically, you felt like a little kid at F.A.O. Schwartz, whose parents just told them anything you want is yours.
Absolutely, absolutely. Like a little kid at F.A.O. Schwartz, you know, it was an exciting, exciting time. And what happened, you know, 8-9 months later, I said I really want to be doing Kosher Wine Society full time. So I spent the next 2 years really developing Kosher Wine Society to a level where we were doing an event at least once a month, maybe twice a month. Some months we do a scotch tasting event. Some months we're going to be starting a networking event. Once a month networking event, come and taste some wines, but it's going to be about opportunities and growing your network and your businesses. And, you know, just, you know, it's – I think with this is there's only opportunity, and maybe that's how I look at life and look at the world, that there is opportunity everywhere, and you know, it's all about how we want to go out there and create the opportunities. And you know, it's love to have your listeners come out and enjoy and experience Kosher Wine Society. And if you know, if they're having a difficulty finding us, you could type kosher wine and you will find us. We're definitely in the top 10. If you type kosher wine, especially in New York, you'll find us.
Now, tell us about some interesting anecdotes in your life in relation to the Kosher Wine Society or in your quest for that perfect wine.
Say the question one more time, the antidote.
Okay. Give us an anecdote or two about the, you know, during your time with the Kosher Wine Society or even in your personal quest towards the perfect wine.
Well, you know, the quest for the perfect wine is you know, I think it's a I think when you're in the quest for the perfect of anything, you kind of miss the opportunity, you know, the opportunities that you have on right in front of your face, you know. So it kind of reminds me of the person that goes out to eat, right? And he's having this, you know, amazing steak or you know, whatever it is, and he's taking a bite of it, and he's talking about the steak he had 2 weeks ago versus enjoying the steak that he had right now, and
that he's having now.
Yeah. And you know, so the quest for the perfect one, I'm not sure that's out there. You know, what's amazing is that there's more and more new wines coming out every single day, every single, you know, week. It's an exciting industry right now, the kosher wine industry. Royal Wine does an event every year, which we're a part of. We sell tickets to. That's exciting. So you know, It's just an exciting time to be in this industry and to be part of it, and I hope that I can contribute more and more to events and to different things as my time gets limited with my, you know, full-time employment it does get harder. And, you know, so I'm always looking for people to help us out and help us, whether it's arrange events or start their own chapters. I mean, Kosher Wine Society is looking for people to start their own chapters in their own cities and really take on being an owner in that area and grow the Kosher Wine Society in a specific area. And there's no better time to do it than now. This is the prime time to do it because we're in the middle of the, like you said, you know, 30 years ago there were no, you know, good quality kosher wines, and you know, right now we're in the heart of it. So it's a very, very exciting time.
Well, kosher wines today are winning international prizes. They are superb wines that just happen to be kosher. And even in France, a lot of the great chateaus that made the great famous wines are now producing kosher wines as well, like Chateau Giraud, Chateau Piada, Chateau Pontécané, and so on.
Smith & Lafitte.
Legendary wines which are now kosher.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many wine makers and wineries that are producing, you know, kosher wine. And, you know, what's the difference between a kosher wine and a non-kosher wine? What's really the difference? The only difference that is that a kosher wine, if you want a hechshor, you want a supervision on your wine, the whole process from beginning to end has to be done by Sabbath observant Jews. So that's the only difference between the two. Is who's watching who's in charge of the actual production of it. The winemaker is the same. You know, it's the same,
right.
You know, it's
right.
The same grapes, it's the same barrel, it's the same everything. The only thing that changes is who's actually going to move the barrel and who's actually going to move the X, Y, and Z.
And
so there's really
right.
No difference between a kosher wine and a non-kosher wine in terms of the actual grape and juice that's in the wine.
That's correct.
Yeah, so
okay.
I think that's something that people don't know, that they think it's blessed or they think it's something different. But what's great is that it's just another...
It's simply a question of supervision, that's all.
That's it.
Okay, tell us again how we can get the 2-for-1 for Tuesday's event and how do people get in touch with you to that effect.
Fantastic. The 2-for-1 for Tuesday's event, they email me, info@kosherwinesociety. They put the name of the show or just mention Chaim's name and send me an email. Say, I'd like to come, 2-for-1. And what I'll do is I'll send you out a little invoice and you can pay it that way. And the other way is that's the only way to get that special. The other way is for the J Deal event. The J Deal is having a deal this weekend for Kosher Wine Society for new wines for the new year. And you know, do me a favor and let me know you heard about it on the show. And you know, it's exciting to be here. And thank you so much, Chaim, for your time and for all that you do for the kosher scene out there. It's I know it's a lot of work, and I hope the opportunity to be here and to contribute is serving and offering you a lot in your life. So I really hope that is true.
Okay, thank you for being on our show. We truly enjoyed it. Hopefully you'll come back again and again. And I hope we'll see you this coming Tuesday and again on the other tasting of
the
21st. Right.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you very, very much. It's been a fun evening, ladies and gentlemen. And we will see you next week when our guest will be David Mintz from Tofuti. Thank you very much. And good night, one and all.
Good night.
Good night.